Hello, I'm Vicky Bourne of Mind in Kingston. Welcome to our podcast, Mind the Chat. It's where we talk to a range of people local to the Kingston area about their mental health experiences. Hearing how others have managed can sometimes be a huge help, and that's what we hope these podcasts will do for you. In this edition...
It's creating these really, really busy days, and I think I probably now am realising that I still pack way too much in, and it means that everything has to go absolutely perfectly in order to be successful really with it. And of course, if anything goes even slightly wrong, it can completely shift me off kilter, and then I can feel it in my body. I can feel my kind of my heart racing, feeling out of control essentially.
Sarah Lamptey there. She suffers from anxiety. Yet on paper, Sarah has it all. She's a graduate in English literature who's forged a career as a successful radio and TV presenter, actor, writer, and model. Not only that, she's a regular volunteer for homelessness charities, and she founded London's first free showers for homeless people, a project called Showerbox. I spoke to her down the line from a bustling pub and started by asking her, where does she think her anxiety stems from?
I have thought about this over the years. So my, I suppose, anxiety that I feel like I've experienced to some degree since I was a teenager actually predated the modelling. I think when I went into modelling, I don't think it helped as such. I mean, it's obviously an industry that's so focused on image, and you're very aware of that from the beginning. It's obviously very centred around weight a lot of the time, not so much in commercial modelling, but you definitely felt that as, you know, as a teenager, that I had to be a certain size in order to do it. I was lucky in the sense that I only actually began to model, you know, with any sort of success once I'd finished university. So I think I had a bit more experience, a bit more maturity under my belt, which was actually really lucky for me, I think. I think if I'd gone and started modelling at college, say, it could have been a really negative experience for me. But I think because I started at 20 and carried on doing commercial modelling since then, and as I said, that went into acting as well, I didn't feel as though I had the pressure on my weight in the same way that I would have if I was doing fashion and I was only sort of 14, you know. And I never did those catwalk shows, and I think that was really lucky as well, because then there really was a focus on being basically a hanger essentially for clothes. I think my anxiety came from perfectionism, I think, when I was growing up, wanting to fit as much as possible into my life, and, you know, to be as successful as I could be, and also this very profound fear of loss, and, you know, the worry around that, I think, just made me feel like I had to immerse myself in every aspect of life, which just became quite an anxiety inducing state, really.
So you mentioned there a profound fear of loss that you've experienced, Sarah. Where do you think that came from?
I'm still unsure where that profound feeling came from. I think I first felt it probably in my teens, my early teens, and it was something that I think I actually was actually very, very affected by, sort of, you know, the media, entertainment. I think I was really aware that that's what I wanted to do in some form. I loved singing, I loved the acting, and actually one example would be Britney Spears, bizarrely. I think she got a Brit when she was 16. And I had this feeling, this very strong feeling, that I was going to get a Brit by the time I was 16, which is completely, completely ridiculous. But I had this kind of, it sounds kind of laughable now, but it was very real for me that that's what I had to achieve. And I would start to set myself those kinds of goals. And then, of course, ridiculously high goals. I mean, not impossible, but almost impossible goals like that. And I would start to do that. And then, of course, that particular goal, as an example, I didn't get the Brit, and I wasn't 16, you know, and then felt this kind of crippling lack of self-worth, I suppose, and the sense that, you know, what was I achieving then, and what next, and kind of began to set these ridiculously high goals it's neurotic perfectionism in that way.
So it's loss of kind of targets that you'd set yourself then?
Well, no, I mean, I suppose I felt very strongly that feeling of trying to set myself goals and fit a lot in life always felt against the backdrop of the sense that time was passing. So that's kind of what I mean about, you know, being 16 and this whole thing about when I'm six, by the time I'm 16, I'll have done this. And then by the time I'm 20, I'll have done this. And I want to have achieved this by that time. Because I was very aware that time was passing and eventually, of course, it will be over. And then what will that be like? So bizarrely, this whole sense of the struggle to achieve always felt very much aligned with the fact that one day I won't be here. And it was very, very strong and a very strong parallel from a very, very young age. And I think in terms of what I'd experienced and where the particular kind of fixation on death, I'm really not sure. I know that when I was in school, I adored World War poetry and this kind of thing, and I became quite kind of immersed in that. My imagination is quite vivid, I would say. I think it's quite strong. And I think when I used to disappear into books, as I did when I was younger, I felt very much as though I was living those characters. And they really came to life for me. And it could possibly have been that I just couldn't control my thoughts maybe at that time. It was just, they were going into all kinds of areas. And I still feel a bit like a dreamer now. But I did sharply feel the loss of, you know, the fear of loss of my parents, which I still feel now. But of course, have techniques to manage those thought processes.
You mentioned having some therapy when you were at university, I think, and the focus that it put on eating issues and food, and that wasn't very helpful. I wondered how you might have wished that would have been different.
So I actually feel as though the counsellor I had at that time really missed the point. I did speak about food, but I think even then I was really aware that it was more to do with control and to do with feeling as though my life is somehow passing me by, which is just ridiculous looking back, you know, when you're only 18. But I felt it so strongly. It was just so real for me at that time. And this particular counsellor seemed to latch on to it and try and almost assist me with it, which seemed balmy to me at the time because I was aware that actually I was controlling that. I was planning that within an inch of my life. I didn't need any help with that. I needed help with why I was doing that. Saying things like, oh, but you can have a jacket potato and that's 300 calories and you can have beans for this amount. And I thought, I know all the calories back to back. I know now. I know exactly. There is not one thing that's passed my lips since I was a teenager that I haven't counted, which is something that I just do automatically now. It's like a quick kind of calculation, which I suppose probably could seem a bit insane. And I don't, you know, bash myself for doing that anymore. I just try not to let it be a focus, and I'm aware that it's something that happens almost automatically now with whatever I eat. And obviously I make decisions in terms of my food, in terms of my food choices. Often I will go for the healthier one, and if I don't, I will push myself to eat maybe the chips, which I love chips, but then I don't necessarily feel great afterwards. But I do really strongly try to push back against the feeling that if I eat this, I will feel like that, or I will be like this. You know, it will somehow mean that I'm gross or I've lost for that day. And I think again with the achievements in life, but the achievements in terms of goal setting with calories and this kind of thing, it's all really one and the same thing, I feel.
You've spoken a little bit about your relationship with food, and it sounds as if you've come to some kind of acceptance and being able to live alongside that in a way that's comfortable for you. But I wondered, you know, how anxiety in other senses manifests itself.
It's creating these really, really busy days. And I think I probably now I'm realizing, you know, that I still pack way too much in. And it means that everything has to go absolutely perfectly in order to be successful, really, with it. And then I can often be running and running throughout the day and not give myself a chance to stop. And of course, if anything goes even slightly wrong, it can completely shift me off kilter, you know, and then I can feel it in my body. I can feel my kind of my heart racing, or the very, you know, sweaty palm kind of feeling of feeling out of control, essentially, when it could be something pretty minor. You know, it could just be that I miss my train and the next one's in 15 minutes, but that would make me feel very, very out of control. Even if I didn't have an appointment, I would be thinking I'm sitting at the train station and there's something else I could be doing with these 15 minutes, you know, and that is quite damaging, I think. And that's, again, trying to breathe out and be in the moment and try to let go as much as possible. But a lot of it's really just talking to myself and trying to be my own kind of best friend in those scenarios.
Were you able to discuss it with family and friends?
I definitely felt like when I was a teenager, that there was a lot of guilt and shame attached to feeling sad, you know, and knowing that I was privileged and I had, you know, a fortunate background. My parents were able to pay for violin lessons, for example. But using that as an example, actually, I think that also became an anxiety-inducing situation, because I never wanted to play the violin. I think my dad had these big dreams himself to be a musician, and what that meant was I wanted to sing, and then I felt constantly every time I picked up the violin that I wasn't, you know, accepted, or there was a lot surrounding that, and I don't know how much of that I created myself. I think my dad was quite strict growing up, overwhelmingly protective. I think it all came from a really good place, but it all, I suppose, fed into this feeling that I needed to do as much as I could do, get as much as I could get out of life whilst I was here. I very much strongly aligned my success with it all being very finite.
And you talked about techniques which help with your anxiety. Could you say a little more about those?
So the therapy at university didn't help really, but I was aware that there was a merit in talking to people and trying to work out my own thought process, and writing really helped. Writing's helped over the years, it helped at that time, and it certainly helps now. My degree is actually in English, but I think creative writing would have been the best degree for me, really, because it just enabled me to have an outlet, and I think that's what we all need, you know, whether it's gardening, you know, putting your fingers in the soil, whether it's music, walking by the river, being on a boat, sitting on a bench, looking at, you know, skimming pebbles, looking at the ducks, you know, having an outlet in whatever form is just so important. And I realise that the simplest of pleasures are often the strongest, really. Nowadays, I really focus on breathing as much as possible. So any rooting myself to the moment techniques are really important, whether it's just listening to the sounds in the room, if I'm eating, trying not to have my phone on. That was a really, really big change for me, was to try to not have my phone on me really until I was actually actively needing to be on my phone, engaging with it. Not to say I wouldn't go on Instagram, for example, but I still try and allocate time to do that. Whereas I think before, it was this feeling that all the aspects of life were kind of layered on top of one another, and I was just doing them all at the same time. And I think technology and modern life really encourages that feeling. You know, it's this whole idea that we have to fit in as much as possible, and we can run around the block, but rather than just running and being in the moment and feeling your body move and the feeling of your heart and your blood racing around your body and looking at what's around you, you've also listening to music or potentially podcasts. And there's this constant feeling, well, I certainly felt that I was always doing at least two things at once, and so one thing at a time, really, just keeping it really, really simple. The techniques are just one thing at a time, you know.
So trying to be more mindful, basically, and appreciate the small things, which is something that perhaps we've all become a lot more aware of during this recent period as well.
Absolutely.
And obviously the industry you were in, it's very much a case of probably having to wait for the next call and wait for the next job. I wondered on another level whether you felt that things had improved for black women in the modelling and media industry in terms of access and representation. We now have a black editor of Vogue, but up until recently, obviously things haven't been good.
Yes, I have. I have seen improvements. I still feel as though it's quite a tokenistic situation. So I feel as though often when there's a black model or an Asian model included in a runway, it feels very much that was a point that they were making, as opposed to a natural decision. And that, I find, really permeates the commercial world as well. I actually read this really kind of distressing article that was talking about commercial modelling, and it said, you know, mixed race girls are chosen to be the BAME choice, because they're more palatable than black girls, say. But mixed race is sort of just, you know, the happy medium, if you like. And this was, of course, an opinion piece, but it got me thinking, that is so destructive. And of course, being somebody who has done a lot of commercial modelling, you know, you do see these briefs and you see someone say, you know, I want someone between 20 and 30 and black, afro. And then, of course, I click it and then I apply and then maybe I'll get the job. And I think, obviously, from the very beginning, they've had the very real idea of what they want this commercial to look like. And not necessarily that's a negative thing, but it feels obviously quite lazy at times.
And moving on a bit, you started volunteering for a homeless charity. Was that when you were at university or a bit later on?
it was a bit later on. So once I left university, I started working for Crisis, actually. So it's Crisis at Christmas, and it's 10 days every Christmas where there are these shelters that pop up around London, I think potentially beyond London, I'm pretty sure beyond London as well. And the whole idea really behind Shellbox is thinking, right, how can I make each life a little bit easier? How can I soften with these showers? How can I soften the daily challenge that these men and women feel, you know, every day? We actually had one gentleman recently that hadn't showered for 5 months, and to be able to offer that with the help of my volunteers and with all these donations that I've been so kindly donated over the past sort of almost 2 years now, that's always my, I suppose, my base, what I come back to every time when I think about Showerbox. What can we do each day? And Vicky, talking about mental health, that's really in essence what I feel. What can we do each day to feel better?
Yeah, so it's a big community facility. It also really helps with your mental health, your self-esteem. So it ticks an awful lot of boxes. And as you say, a lot of these things are things that we've become a lot more aware of recently. Well, it certainly sounds like you've done an awful lot to kind of change and improve things. And it's really good that you've managed to get the service up and working again post the main bit of lockdown anyway, Sarah. And I just wondered how you'd cope generally during the last few months. I'm asking all my guests this, but it's always interesting to hear about the challenges.
Yes, absolutely. You know, it was like running and hitting a wall. It was like running nonstop, you know, the beginning of this year, and then just suddenly hitting a big brick wall, because obviously things had to stop overnight. And for me, my work obviously all stopped, like it did for a lot of freelancers. And I'd actually just come back from losing my uncle, which was just the most, it's like the world shifted on its axis earlier this year, because we found out that he passed away in Ghana very suddenly, and we're not 100% sure what happened. And he lived with us, and he was just a wonderful human, and I was extremely close to him, as was my father, and he was my father's little brother. And it was just so devastating, and it still is, you know. And we went to the funeral in Ghana, came back straight into lockdown actually. So it was very disorientating, the whole
like
experience.
A lot of people, not really the opportunity to grieve properly, I imagine.
Absolutely. I think it's coming in spurts now. We were kind of seeing all these reports when we were in Ghana post the funeral, and thinking, God, are we even going to get back? Or, you know, it was just very, very extremely intense. And I think a lot of people have obviously experienced that. So back into lockdown in London, and then of course work stops, and it very much was enforced stillness. And I think that was probably very valuable for me in a way. I really had to work on thinking, how am I going to create structure in my day? From somebody who packs in as much as they can in each day, it was actually, I realised how vital that was. Again, I think if this lockdown had happened when I was, you know, 10 years ago, say, I think I would have found it extremely, extremely challenging. I think I'm not sure how I would have coped, although I have got a brilliant support network. But I think just, you know, with an overthinking disposition, as I have, I think it would have been a real struggle. I think now, being, you know, another massive technique for me is just walks and exercise. Of course, the gym's closed, so I couldn't get that element of exercise, swimming, which I absolutely love, and which somewhat enables me to breathe out the stresses around food and try and channel it in a way that's more positive. That I obviously wasn't able to have that as an outlet, but walks were fantastic. So I was walking for 1 to 2 hours a day and doing messages and sitting in the park. And, you know, again, all the simplest of things in life are often the ones that are the most effective. And so to break up the day in that way was really important, and to make sure I got up at a certain time. I think for me, because I was so busy, I had to kind of build different elements into my life and kind of create a level of structure.
Yeah, I think that sounds sort of familiar for most of us, really, a mixture of highs and lows and things we've discovered about ourselves and different ways of living. And finally, Sarah, you're local to the Kingston area and you grew up around here. I wondered if there were any special places or places that you like going to and things that have helped when you've been feeling anxious or times have been tough.
Absolutely. I mean, what an area to feel anxious in, I guess, because Richmond Park has just been an absolute character in my life. You know, if I was going to write a book of it, Richmond Park would definitely have a lead role. Of course, Cambury Gardens, Kingston. Cambury Gardens has got a special place in my heart anyway, because it was where we used to sit by the river as kids. And I used to play tennis there and do rollerblading growing up. It's such a beautiful area to grow up in. So yes, I've now moved to Oxford with my fiancé, and we live in where I am now, in Osney Island. And we're surrounded by canals here. And it's, again, that feeling that I need to be, you know, being by water, being by the Thames. It's just lovely to feel like I'm actually by the Thames here as well. I feel kind of connected to Kingston somehow. It's a really special place to be in. And I think to immerse oneself in nature as much as possible is the key, really.
I was speaking there to the radio and TV presenter, Sarah Lamptey, who grew up in Kingston. Remember, if you've been affected by any of the issues raised in this podcast, do seek the help and advice of a medical professional. I'm Vicky Bourne of Mind in Kingston, and until the next time, take good care.